welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden age. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, and coming up in this hour, science fiction. Later on, the story, The Cave of Night, on X-1. But first, it's Exploring Tomorrow, a mutual broadcast from June 25th, 1958, called The Adventure of the Beauty Queen.
The program you are about to hear is largely fiction, science fiction. We make no guarantees, however, how long it will remain fiction.
Exploring Tomorrow. And now, here is your guide to these adventures of the mind, John Campbell, Jr.
The philosophers down the ages have hassled a long time and with many words about the good, the true, and the beautiful. The true, that can be defined pretty objectively. But there's a peculiar thing about beautiful. What is beauty? And in whose terms? Makes it difficult.
With the story of The Adventure of the Beauty Queen, which stars Miss Charlotte Sheffield, Miss United States of 1958.
Beauty is a much more complicated problem than the question of truth, actually. A truth is an eternal thing. If it's true, it's true, and that's that. But beauty is appropriate. It changes as the situations change. It changes with time. I wonder how our own concepts of beauty, that is, our human race's concepts of beauty, will change as time goes by. Let's suppose that a famous young woman of our time, Miss United States, if you like, is awakened in her sleep by an alien presence, a strange force she feels but cannot see, yet something she knows is there.
Who are you?
You know I am here.
Yes.
Can you see me?
No.
Nor can I see you. But I am conscious I am with you.
Dreaming is, of course.
No. No, it's real.
Who are you?
A man who, in your terms, belongs to the distant future. I am unborn, in the way you think of it. And to me, you have been dead over 1,000 years, were I back in my own orbit.
Someone's playing a joke.
No. This is no joke. But please, don't be afraid. I mean no harm.
I've been dead 1,000 years. Whoever you are, what are you talking about?
Listen to me. Try to understand. I belong to a race of scientists. In simple words you can understand, we have a device which enables us to project ourselves into the past. You belong to the past. Do you understand?
Yes.
The device has made me conscious of you for a long time. I have used it to explore the past, and in these explorations, I have searched for the highest form of human beauty.
How do you know whether or not I'm beautiful if you can't see me?
The device tells me you're beautiful. Beauty, real beauty, is a force that transmits itself, that can be picked up by a form of radar. Please understand, I'm only using terms I think you can follow. In my own orbit, I would not even talk to a child in such simple terms.
Go away. Please go away.
But I can't. I'm in love with you.
What?
In love with you.
In love?
Yes.
Oh.
Very much. Is it funny?
Oh, yes.
I don't think it is.
But it is.
Do women of your time always laugh at a man's love?
Oh, don't be silly. I wasn't laughing at you.
Well, then at what?
I just thought it was very funny. The idea of your being in love with a blip on a radar screen. After all, that's about what I am to you, isn't it?
Oh, no.
It must be.
No, no. The radar screen, as you call it, simply picked you up, pointed you out to us.
Us?
My associates and I.
Oh.
I felt very strongly drawn to you. I convinced my associates to conduct further experiments. Actual contact with someone out of the past. You. I had to know you. I had to come into orbit with you.
Look, don't you think this joke has gone far enough?
I told you this is not a joke.
Of course it is.
Well, you know better.
Oh, don't you suppose I know what's going on? Oh, I should have thought of it a long time ago.
What is going on?
Why, it's very simple. Someone installed a radio pickup in this room. And you're talking to me through a microphone.
Talking to you?
You are, aren't you?
Oh, no.
What do you mean, no?
I'm not talking to you in the way you think I am. I'm projecting to you.
Oh, please stop this.
But it's not your voice I hear. I'm receiving impulses from you, not actual words. The device I mentioned interprets the nature of your impulses, translates them into my language. It does the same for you.
It's true. I don't hear your voice. Not as a sound, I mean.
You begin to realize.
Please stop.
No, don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid. You must be insane to say that. I'm scared out of my life. I want to scream. I'm afraid to. I'm not even sure I'm awake. I'm not even sure I'm alive.
You're alive. In your century. Now, understand what I'm telling you. In a moment, you'll be drawn out of your orbit, projected into the future, into my orbit. I want to see you. I want to see if you're as beautiful as your impulses say you are. If you are, I'm afraid I'll keep you where I am in the future.
No, I don't believe any of it. You're mad. Whoever you are, you're quite insane.
Are you receiving me? Don't be afraid. You're in limbo, on your way into my orbit. Exploring Tomorrow continues in just a moment.
All of us, as American citizens, believe in our inherent liberties and freedoms, such as the freedom of the individual to choose and elect his own national representatives. It has been said that there is only one ruling class in America, the people themselves, who, through their vote, have established the law of our land. The real importance of this freedom depends on our accepting the responsibility not only to know what we are voting for or against, but also to choose our leaders for the best interests of the nation. So, accept your responsibility and ensure your freedom.
Of all things men have discussed and considered today, time is the one of which we know least. We know how to travel in space, and recent physical work has indicated that actually things can travel backwards as well as forwards in time. But we know nothing about it. And one of the things that would be strange on this, how long does it take to travel through time? When you are traveling through time itself, how long does it take to go from now to then? How long was Miss United States in that limbo before she was there?
I'm talking to you. I'm projecting to you. Are you receiving me?
Yes.
Are you afraid?
A little.
Not as much as you thought you'd be.
No.
Have you any idea of where you are?
I'm in a room. That's all I know.
I'm in the next one. We're on the 500th floor of the Institute of Technical Research in the city of Columbia. In your century, I believe you called it Washington.
Washington?
You understand, this is America.
I'm glad to hear that, at least.
Yes, I can see it relieves you.
You can see me?
Very clearly.
And am I?
Are you what?
Well, what you expected me to be.
To some extent.
Do you find me unattractive?
Alien.
Alien?
Different.
Yes, I know the meaning of the word.
At first, I was conscious of a sense of shock when I first saw you.
At least you're frank.
Well, I'm a scientist.
Do you find me ugly?
I said alien. Of course, I knew you would be. I didn't expect you to measure up physically to our standards. The human form has improved a great deal since your century.
But why? Was there a reason?
Man-made reasons.
Can you tell me?
Well, it began with interplanetary wars conducted by the nations of the world. A struggle to build empires in outer space on other planets.
When was this?
Oh, not in your century. You saw only the first feeble attempts to explore space.
Yes, I suppose our attempts are feeble.
Well, the interplanetary wars did a great deal of destruction, particularly on this planet. Precious documents, books, records were lost. But there was another result. The atmosphere of the Earth became charged with radioactive matter. For a while, it looked as though the human race would become extinct, but it didn't. The human body acclimated itself to new atmospheric conditions and flourished again. But by that time, our physical form had changed. Changed for the better. And today...
Go on.
Well, today, the human form is the most beautiful creation has ever seen.
And by your standards, I am something of a shock to you.
Your physical form was, at first, yes.
Am I very different from the women here?
Very different.
To you, they're beautiful.
They are beautiful.
Would I find them attractive?
I don't think so.
I might.
Oh, no.
Why not? If they're so beautiful, I mean.
Well, your conception of beauty is not ours.
I understand that, but...
But what?
I don't know. I was going to say that beauty is beauty, but that wouldn't make any sense.
No, the concept of beauty is what matters.
But you said beauty is a force. It radiates.
The inner beauty radiates.
I understand that, too.
Well, how do you think of the universe?
Oh, I think I associate it with God. Identify it with the divine mind.
I'm surprised.
The universe is a reflection of God.
Now I begin to understand why, in spite of your physical form, your beauty reached me. And it has nothing to do with your looks.
I wouldn't be very gracious if I didn't say thank you.
I'm going to keep you here, you know, if I can.
I don't think you quite mean that.
I mean it in every sense. I want you now to remember what I've said about the change for the better in human form. I'm going to open the door to your room and come in. Now please keep in mind that I do not look as the men of your century looked, but also remember that here I'm supposed to be a reasonably good-looking fellow.
I would like to see you.
Well, you will in the next few seconds.
That which is beautiful and befitting, appropriate, depends on the environment it's in. The future people had had to undergo some rather complete changes to meet the environment that, shall we say, we, their ancestors, had imposed on them. A little too much radioactivity. And that which was beautiful is no longer befitting. The thing that is now befitting, we might not think of as particularly beautiful.
Is it so bad?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I should not have exposed myself to the shock you feel, to the revulsion you feel at the sight of me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I
should have known.
Forgive me. I just can't look at you for a moment. I have to adjust.
There's a window behind you. You can look out.
Oh, thank you. Please, don't resent me.
No, I was just wondering if you have any idea how incredible to me your revulsion is.
Yes, I think I have an idea.
You must overlook what sounds like vanity, but I have to repeat what I told you before. I'm supposed to be more than passably good-looking.
Yes, I understand.
But you can't stand the sight of me.
Give me a moment. Are you looking at me?
Yes.
Does it still hurt you?
No. No, I'm too conscious of your inner beauty.
I'm very grateful.
I'm curious about something.
Yes?
Are you conscious of any of my impulses?
I think so.
Do you find them hostile?
No.
Alien?
No.
Do they cause you any fear?
I don't think so.
Well, forgetting how I appear to your eyes, do you like me?
Yes. Yes, I think you must be a very nice person.
The curious thing is...
Yes?
I was going to say, the curious thing is I'm still in love with you.
You mustn't be.
Perhaps love is a dimension.
I don't know. Oh, I'm too confused to think about it.
Or perhaps it's an orbit we enter or leave. I don't know either. It was just a thought.
You can't examine love through a microscope, can you?
Well, it's been exposed to every kind of study for centuries. Even the people of your time knew its reactions to be purely chemical. Of course, your poets didn't agree, but then neither do ours.
Do you have poets?
Oh, yes, we have them. They resist us. They call themselves the last human barrier against science. They refuse to understand what basic science is.
What is it?
Well, isn't it man's eternal craving to find out more about the universe, the divine mind?
Let me go back.
Go back?
Please.
How can you even want to go back? Look, what do you see through that window? Nothing but beauty. Miles of emerald green fields with cities that sparkle like diamonds rising out of them. Nothing but prosperity. Prosperity and peace. And you want to go back to your miserable century?
To my people. To my own people. I belong with them. I don't belong here.
I'll tell you something. We're being observed, listened to by my associates.
Observed?
Well, the final decision must come from them. I'm as much a part of this experiment as you are, even though it was my idea. My idea. Now that we've succeeded in drawing you out of your orbit into ours, I don't think our science will release you. We can learn a great deal from you about the things of your century. Besides, I love you. I want to keep you here.
Please. Please don't touch me. Please don't touch me. Dream. That's all it was. It couldn't have been anything else. It couldn't have been.
There are parts of beauty that are eternal, that are not like the physical, that changes. But the beauty of a true and honest personality, this sort of beauty, that will endure. There are things that you can rely on as time goes by. Woman needs man, man must have his mate. On this you can rely. The only thing is, the definition of man and woman will tend to change with the passing of ages. But the fundamental things apply. An honest man and an honest woman. These we need forever.
Join us for a fascinating adventure in Exploring Tomorrow. Heard in our cast tonight were Brett Morrison and the real Miss United States of 1958, Charlotte Sheffield. Script was by John Fleming. Produced and directed by Sanford Marshall here in New York, Guy Wallace speaking. We pause now for station identification.
Exploring Tomorrow, on Tuned to Yesterday, from June 25th, 1958, on Mutual. That was an Armed Forces Radio Service rebroadcast, starring Brett Morrison, who for many years played the part of the Shadow on Mutual Radio. You are listening to an hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Author James E. Gunn's story, The Cave of Night, is next on X-1, the first of five of his stories adapted on the series, among them the memorable Open Warfare, about a professional golf player playing against the perfect golfer robot. This episode first heard on February 1st, 1956.
One, fire. Horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents Tonight's story, The Cave of Night, by James E. Gunn.
Wait one little, Charlie. Okay. Though yet of Hamlet, our dear brothers, death the memory be made with... Well, anyway, how's it, okay?
Okay.
Check recording, will you? I may go over a half hour. Make sure you've got another reel of tape ready. Okay? All right, Look, Bill, I've just put the segments of tape together for the next week's show. I'm going to record my narrations, and we'll listen to it together tomorrow. I know this is unusual, but you're the producer, and I don't want you out on a limb that may be sawed off behind us. This week's show is liable to either win us every award from the Peabody to the Pulitzer Prize, or maybe put the network out of business. Okay, we start with a standard opening. Behind the world, etc., 40 seconds. This is Harry Anders, your editor. At 8 o'clock, after the sun has set and the sky is darkening, look up. There's a man up there where no man has ever been. He is lost in the cave of night.
And the fuel tank's empty. Receiver broken. Transmitting and clear. Anyone picking this up, anyone. This is Rev McMillan calling. Notify Goddard Rock, New Mexico. No way to get back.
There's a man up there where no man has ever been. He is lost in the cave of night. We all know that phrase now, the cave of night. It was written by a poet disguised in the cynical hide of a newspaper rewrite man. But it stuck. It caught the world and held it like a butterfly pinned to a board. It started with a ham, an amateur radio operator, in Davenport, Iowa. All right, Eddie. Roll the first tape in here. It's marked.
Am I too close? I was up in the attic. I usually have a talk with WG73. He's in Buenos Aires. We play chess. Well, there was some kind of interference. And then all of a sudden, I heard this voice. I record most of my listening anyway, so I had the tape machine running. After I heard it, I called civil defense. That's what we're supposed to.
Look, Bill, I haven't done the final editing on these tapes, so don't worry if they're a little rough. Down out of the night, flung from the darkness, came these words, the first of so many that electrified the world.
Notify Goddard Rock, New Mexico. No way to get back. No way to get back. I'm stuck up here. No way to get down.
What does it take to catch the pity of the world? A man wedged underground in Kentucky. A little girl in the bottom of a well. Somebody alive, waiting for rescue, with the days of his life numbered. Somebody somewhere waiting for us to get him out. The story broke in this morning's papers. Orbiting 1,000 miles above our heads was a man, an officer of the United States Air Force in a fuelless spaceship. We're recording at the desk of Mike Bayless, senior night editor of the Continental Press National Wire.
Hey, you always get a reaction like this. I remember the Floyd Collins story in the 20s. Fellow trapped in that cave in Kentucky, remember?
Oh, sure.
And the whole country hanging on to see if he could get out. Then there was that little girl stuck in the well, Kathy Fiskus?
Yeah.
Yeah, we pulled all those stories out and put them on the wire for background. But this hit bigger. We got the first lead from an Air Force handout in New Mexico. They just said an experimental rocket failed to return to base. But by that time, the cat was out of the bag. Ham operators picked up those messages from Boston to Fairbanks, Alaska.
Mr. Bayless, you first used the phrase the Cave of Night, didn't you?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you know, you got to get a little purple on a thing like this. People eat it up. You can't spread it on too thick. Anyway, I was lost in a cave once when I was a kid in upstate New York. I waited around for a couple of hours in the dark until they came for me. It kind of reminded me of that.
It reminded the world of terrors at night, of struggling awake through nightmares, the fears of loneliness, darkness, falling, suffocation, thirst. It reminded me of Rev McMillan. And perhaps I have an advantage over all the other reporters for newspapers and radio and television because I knew Rev McMillan. I knew him in college and in the Air Force. I knew that he was testing rocket-powered craft at Goddard, but I didn't know they were so close to space. No one knew. Till those messages of desperation crackled down through the atmosphere. I remembered Rev when I saw those headlines that morning. Straight black hair, Clark Gable ears, a reckless grin. He ate well, reveled in expert jazz and Mozart opera, and he talked incessantly. His southern speech was no drawl. There was too much to say. And now he was alone. And soon all that might be extinguished. The men from the radio newsrooms rushed to Goddard rocket base armed with Ninja tape recorders.
Well, we're going to get a story on it. Gentlemen, I'm Colonel Arthur J. Hannigan, information officer for Goddard rocket base. I'm authorized to issue the following statement. First Lieutenant Reverty L. McMillan, United States Air Force pilot, Experimental Rocket Division, took off from Goddard Base at 2234 Rocky Mountain Time. As craft, the XR-37 Mark II, a hydrazine nitric three-stage rocket. I'm sorry I can't describe it, boys. Classified. Well, in order to maintain orbit, the motors were pulsed for 1 second every 15 seconds elapsed time. After 3 minutes, the exhaust was seen by ground spectroscope observation to flare for half a minute. As fuel supply is exhausted, the craft has reached sustaining orbital speed.
Well, what does that mean, Colonel?
He's out of gas. He can't get down.
The first mobilization was of the scientific brains massed at Goddard. Few of them knew Rev. Brains at a research project are usually carefully sorted out and salted away from the distractions of the outside world. They designed, they invented, they calibrated and theorized. But they didn't know the short, stocky man with a lopsided grin who rode the fruit of their labor up and out and now circled the world of his birth with time ticking out. I covered the hearings in Washington for the network newsroom. I flew down from New York, and the stewardess came out every few minutes to tell the passengers the latest news. She called him Rev, although she never knew him, and once I thought I saw a tear. The hearing was before the subcommittee of the Senate Committee on Military Affairs. Presiding, Senator Alan J. Hagister of Kentucky.
All right, General Finch. You've made the technical situation fairly comprehensive, even to an old canebrake, redneck hillbilly like myself.
I have tried to make the gravity of the situation apparent, sir.
It appears to me, General, that the sacred life of a human being created in the image of his maker is in danger. It is no light thing to be thrown away like some guinea pig. If that ship wasn't safe, if that poor man up there in the Cave of Night is to die, somebody is responsible. Isn't that right, General?
Sir, a manned rocket was sent up because of one simple fact. It takes a computer of tremendous versatility and capacity to operate a Harrison Munch reactor engine. A computer of infinite complexity.
And I ask you, General, I put a question to you. Why was such a computer not designed?
It has been designed, sir. It was designed 500,000 years ago. There is only one mechanism competent to handle those controls, sir. That is the human brain.
All right. I turn now to my second question, General, and I ask it not only for myself and my colleagues on this committee, but for 170 million Americans listening on the radio, watching on television. With that man up there living out his last day, why was it not possible to send a ship up after him? Why was there no second ship built?
For one reason, Senator, money. The appropriation for rocket research fell short by 12% of the amount needed even to build one vessel. Oh, frankly, gentlemen, the deficiency was made up by cutting corners and diverting funds from other projects.
That is not the point, General. There's a man up there who's going to die.
With the limited funds you gave us, we've done what we set out to do. We've demonstrated that space flight is possible, that a space platform is feasible. If there is any inefficiency, if there is any blame for what has happened, it lies at the door of those who lack the confidence and the courage and ability of their countrymen to fight free of Earth to their greatest glory. Senator, how did you vote on that?
Gallery of the Washington National Cathedral. This is a special prayer service called by the Dean of the Cathedral for the safety of Lieutenant McMillan and for the success of the recently announced rescue plan. The church is filled. There's a sprinkling of high Navy, Army, and Air Force uniforms. I see General Finch in the second row, next to the Secretary of the Air Force and the newly appointed Undersecretary of Defense, Mr. Whinnaker. Prominently displayed in the center aisle, below the ornate railing separating the pews from the altar, is the small model of McMillan's ship. One by one now, the congregation is filing past, dropping checks, bills. I saw one child drop in 12 pennies one by one. All contributions are to be used to defray the cost of the rescue effort. The congregation is now kneeling to pray. A moment of silent prayer will follow for the safety and rescue of Lieutenant McMillan.
$1 billion was raised in 1 week from voluntary contributions. $1.5 billion was appropriated unanimously by Congress. The race began. Would the rescue party reach the ship in time? Of course, we didn't know then. And daily we listen to the voice of the man we hoped to buy back from death. Now, look, Bill, on these McMillan broadcast tapes, don't let some ignorant engineering vice president holler because it's not broadcast quality. Believe me, I knew McMillan. More of that wild Texan in these tapes than in any hi-fi super-frequency response studio recordings. Just listen. You'll see what I mean.
I've been staring out the portholes. I never tire of it. Through the window at the right, I I see a black velvet curtain with a strong light behind it. There are pinpoint holes in the curtain, and the light shines through, not winking the way stars do, but steady. There's no air up here, that's the reason. My oxygen is holding out better than I expected. By my figures, it should last 27 days more. I shouldn't use so much of it talking all the time, but it's hard to stop. Talking, I feel as if I was still in touch with the Earth. Still one of you. Even though I am way up here. Too bad the receiver is broken, but if it had to be one or the other, I'm glad it was the transmitter that came through all right. There's only one of me. There are billions of you to talk to. You can't see me now. You'll have to wait hours for the dawn. I'll have mine in a few minutes.
That's the way he talked. And as we listened to the lonely voice from the night, the engineers, the scientists, the construction men worked round the clock. General Finch presented the problem in the pool interview. I asked the questions for the combined networks that afternoon. Most of you heard the complete broadcast live as he briefed the world with the clipped laconic delivery of a soldier.
There are two basic problems. We've recovered the first and second stages of the rocket. We've only to construct the third stage. The second problem is more difficult. The pilot. Lieutenant McMillan was the only man physically and psychologically qualified. We discover that in our first program. His training and orientation took 18 months. We have now to duplicate this in 27 days.
You think it's possible, General?
I don't know. That's all, Mr. Anders. Stevenson, get me some coffee, will you? Black and some kind of sandwich. No butter, no mayonnaise.
And then the voice from the cave asked a question and expected no answer.
Do you hear me down there? Sometimes I wonder. I wish there was some way I could be sure you were hearing me. Just that one thing might keep me from going crazy.
I was there the night we answered that question. I was there in a helicopter over Kansas City.
This is Harry Anders speaking to you from a helicopter over Kansas City. There are 15 seconds till midnight. The plan was developed by General Finch. At precisely midnight, every light in the city will be out and then flashed on in 2-second intervals. This will be the exact moment that McMillan's ship is calculated to pass overhead. It's almost time now. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. There they go. Off. On. Off. On. Off. On.
I see it. I see it. Kansas City winking at me. Oh, yes, I can see it. Thanks. Thanks. You're listening. I know that now. I'm not alone. I'll never forget. I'm waiting for you.
We're recording in the press gallery of the Goddard Rocket Base main construction hangar. The vast third stage component stands before us, men swarming up and down the gantry cranes. The Mark III is being built to carry 5 men instead of 1. The pilot selection has been kept a top secret to avoid unnecessary strain on the men selected. The latest progress report gives a possible margin of 6 hours between the launching of the rescue ship and the estimated exhaustion supply of oxygen to Lieutenant McMillan. Well, the ship is changing now. The expert construction work is recruited from across the country by the combined efforts of the Air Force Personnel Service, the Atomic Energy Commission, and the International United Electrical Workers and United Auto Workers of the AFL-CIO. The margin is 6 hours. 6 hours between life and death for Lieutenant Reverdy L. McMillan.
An hour ago, I saw the sun rise over Russia. any other land here. It's a green when it should be green. Farther north, a sort of mud color. And then white where the snow is still deep. Up here, you wonder why we're so different when the land is the same. You think we're all the same children of the same mother planet. Who says we're different?
Can you hear me in the back?
Yes, a little
phone. Well, how about this?
That's better.
All right, gentlemen, I have exactly 5 minutes for the press conference, therefore I'm not going to answer any questions. Progress report is as follows. As a safety factor, we're constructing 2 complete 3-stage rockets and 6 additional 3rd-stage components. The telemetered reports from McMillan's ship have added important additional information, and the first of the rescue vessels should be ready to be launched at the estimated time, weather permitting. Now, don't ask a question. Within certain limitations of air turbulence, the rocket will be ready to lift in time to save Lieutenant McMillan.
21 days. Here's bad tonight. I can seem to get a full breath. Stick in the lungs. It doesn't matter, though. But I wish you could see what I've seen. The vast, spreading universe around Earth like a bride in a soft veil. You'd know then that we belong out here. Come out, mankind. Come out and see what I have seen.
This is Harry Anders at Goddard Rocket Base. The Harrison Munch reactor engine for the first 3rd-stage rescue is being tested here at Goddard. You can hear the roaring of the gases in the test chamber behind me. The work has been stepped up as a new calculation based on the increased temperature reading from McMillan's ship indicates that the exhaustion time will be some 6 hours earlier than originally estimated. The margin of rescue will be in minutes. Anders, tape 323. We're in the press operation room of Goddard Field. The rescue rocket has been aloft 53 minutes plus. Its calculated time of arrival is 54 minutes. You will hear the voice of General Beauregard Finch on a direct pickup from the rescue vessel, which has been named unofficially the Lifesaver. Silent crowds have collected at the outer perimeter of the rocket base, as if by their presence they might help it.
Come, quiet, quiet.
The next voice you hear will be General Finch, aloft in the rescue ship. The voice quality may not be good. He's speaking over a throat mic in his pressure suit.
Mark 3 to base. This is Finch. We'll secure that. We are just secured to the airlock of McMillan's ship. I'm now entering the lock. The inner door is closed. I have closed the outer door. The inner door is cycling. Now it is open. Bring in those oxy bottles, man. The Bulkhead to the control room is open.
Is he all right?
Come on, will you? What's happening?
Lieutenant McMillan is dead. He died heroically, waiting till all hope was gone. Until every oxygen gauge stood at zero. And then, well, the airlock was open when we arrived. In accordance with his own wish, his body will be left here in its eternal orbit. I'm going to leave now. My feet will be the last to touch this deck. Lieutenant McMillan is in his control chair, staring out towards the stars. I'll leave the airlock doors open behind me. Let the airless, frigid arms of space protect and preserve for all eternity this man they would not let go.
Well, that's the show, Bill. Bill, you remember at the conference we hadn't made up our mind whether to pick anything up from the celebration last night after the news of the Mars landing? I said it was the right end for Rev McMillan's story. You said it was old stuff. Every kid knew the sequence. The ships built to rescue Rev used to set up the satellite base, from the base to the moon and now to Mars. Well, I went out with a mini-tape last night, and I've got the end of the story. Here it is. This is Harry Anders in Times Square. The neon rocket ship at the top of the Times building has just flashed into brilliant light. The signal that the landing signal has been received from the rocket Rev McMillan III. Man has landed on Mars. And a holiday crowd here in Times Square is celebrating like a thousand New Year's rolled into one. I'm being tossed and pushed and clapped on the back all at once. Let's see what the man on the street thinks about man on Mars. You, sir. I'm broadcasting.
No.
How do you feel about it, sir? How do you feel tonight about man's conquest of space, of the planet?
Leave me alone. I'm in a hurry.
Well, just a few words.
Look, you get your hands off me. Let go of me. I'm not in.
Well, wait a minute, sir. Wait. Riv, come back here. Riv. Do you think I could listen to that voice over and over in a tape editing room and not know every vowel, every consonant? I'm telling you, Bill, I saw him. Rev McMillan. The black hair was gray and those Clark Gable ears were pinned back, but that's a simple operation. I played that piece of tape over and over. It was Rev. I know it. He isn't up there. He's alive. We've got it, Bill. We've got it on our show. We'll break it. Rev McMillan is alive. I haven't written it yet, but we finish it off with this, with a question. Why did they announce he was dead? I'm in the tape editing room now. I've got the reel ready to record the answer.
Excuse me, Mr. Anders. I'm...
Just a minute. I'm recording. You better see the page outside
Mr.
of the...
Mr. Anders, I'd like to talk to you for a moment, if I may. I have a letter of authorization.
Just a minute. I'll be through in a minute. Look, Bill, I've got the answer now. Last night, they landed on Mars. But that first ship... The one that circles up there now. There isn't anybody on it. There never was, except a 30 days recording and a transmitter. That's all. He was never up there. They didn't have the money for a manned rocket. They wanted a crash program all out, so they sent a decoy up. And we all broke our hearts to rescue the man who wasn't there. Oh, he must be laughing, General Finch and the rest of them, the ones that knew. Yeah, I guess they had a problem. What to do with Rev? I wonder if he slipped away from whatever guards they have around him to see the celebration. He looked a little sad. Now, I think sometimes he must wish he was really up there in the cave of night, seated in the icy control room, 1,075 miles above the Earth, staring out at the stars.
Mr. Anders, I must insist...
What? Bill. Looks as if I won't have to worry about editing this tape. My friends are from Washington.
I'd like to call your attention to the last paragraph.
What? No. It's very simple. You won't have to burn it. It's easy to destroy recording tape. I throw this switch. When the tape goes through the erasing head, it's gone forever. Oh, too bad. Would have made one fine show. Okay. So long, Rev.
just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, which this month features an exciting serial, Slave Ship, by Frederick Pohl. Tonight, by transcription, X-1 has brought you The Cave of Night, a story from the pages of Galaxy written by James E. Gunn and adapted for radio by Ernest Kenoy. Featured in the cast were Alexander Scourby, Joe DeSantis, Grant Richards, Louis Van Ruten, Charles Carroll, John Moore, and Bob Hastings. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by Daniel Sutter and is an NBC Radio Network production.
X-1 on Tuned 2 yesterday from February 1st, 1956 on NBC. And so closes this hour of science fiction on Tuned 2 yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden years. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVonier. Thanks for listening.